My name's Rob Heimer. I first met our speaker tonight, Timothy Radcliffe, when I was had just arrived at Blackfriars as a postgraduate, and went off on a walk across Port Meadow with some of the students and friars, so the members of the Dominican Order, the Order of Preachers. And one of the friars was Father Timothy, and we were sort of chatting about this and that, and talking about the commons, the Port Meadows, the commons, and the fencing of the commons, and bit by bit, Timothy said, "Well, yeah, I used to have a job in Rome, and oh, I happened to visit all the 100+ countries that the Dominicans are in at least 2 times, and I started a job in Rome. What's the story here?" So I first encountered our speaker as a warm and wise man, and found out that he was served as a master of the Dominican Order worldwide, and he's also a well-known author. Just a quick look. I've been enjoying this book, I Call You Friends, that has some interviews about Timothy's life and some talks he's given here and there. And then more recently, he's published What is the Point of Being a Christian? And most recently, Why Go to Church? The Drama of the Eucharist, which the Archbishop of Canterbury picked as his book for Lent. It looks like 3 years ago. It's a great pleasure to have Father Timothy here, and would you join with me in welcoming him?
Thank you very much, Rob. I always feel it's a bit odd if you arrive and you talk to people before you really know them. And I would love to have had some time to get to know you and to know what you worry about and what you think about and what you wrestle with before I speak. And I often feel when I give a lecture a bit like one of our brethren who gave a lecture in Chicago. And when he sat down, the applause was a little bit unenthusiastic. So he turned and he said to the man beside him, he said, "Well, it wasn't that bad, was it?" And the man said, "Oh, I don't blame you at all. I don't blame you. I just blame whoever asked you to come and speak in the first place." What I thought I'd share with you is a few very simple thoughts. I hope that you won't find them too simple, about what I call the paradoxes of sanctity. And this afternoon, when I was sort of honing things, I thought to myself, this is really rather absurd to go and talk to people about holiness. I'm reminded of the man who was asked, Lord Longford, whether he knew of any good books on humility. And he said, "There's only one really good book on humility, and I wrote it myself," he said. First of all, just a very brief clarification. When we talk about the saints, of course, as most of you will realise, that in the beginning, this referred to all Christians. St. Paul writes to the church of God that is in Corinth, including all the saints throughout Achaia. All Christians were considered to be saints because they shared the life of the Holy God. They shared his Holy Spirit. It doesn't mean to say that they were all extremely good. In fact, St. Paul is always telling them they're not. To be a saint was not primarily a statement about the moral quality of your life. It said that you shared the life of God. And just as Jesus shared the lives of prostitutes, of tax collectors, and all sorts of people, So saints were those who shared the life of the Holy God, regardless of whether they were in fact particularly good or holy. They were Christ's friends. And what you see is a shift in that meaning. Because when the times of persecution really began to bite, and many people, many of our earliest forebears, began to betray the gospel, to deny Christ, then increasingly, the saints were considered those who gave public witness, who were martyrs, which is what, of course, means witness, to Christ's friendship. So they were the people who stood out, if you want, heroically in times of difficulty, and show what it means to be a friend of God. Now, sanctity, being holy, does sound a bit dull. In the Eustace Diamonds by Anthony Trollope, there was an old admiral who he said, lived life to the full until the very end, by which he meant wine, women, and whist. Well, the whist sounds a bit boring. Or Helen Gurley Brown, the editor of Cosmopolitan, famously said, good girls go to heaven, bad girls go everywhere. And of course today, you know, we use the word wicked to mean exciting. A friend of mine called Terry Eagleton wrote a book about evil. And his son said to him, Daddy, what are you writing about? And he said, I'm writing about evil. And his son said, oh, Dad, that's wicked. It's just living on the edge, you know, being adventurous. And it makes goodness sound thoroughly dull. And I think that this is completely wrong. Because holiness, sanctity, basically means becoming, with the grace of God, painfully and slowly, the person that God created you to be. It means becoming actually somebody who is unique. Our society is obsessed with identity, and I'll come back to that at the very end. You'll know that the end is nigh when you hear. Our society is obsessed with identity, but we tend to buy our identities, you know, off the social equivalent of Marks and Spencer's, off the peg. And so the saint is somebody who learns painfully to be nonconformist, not to be swept up, if you want, into the social expectations of his time, and to be someone. Most of us are actually run away from being someone in particular. A famous Hasidic rabbi called Uzziah said, when I shall face the celestial tribunal, I shall not be asked why I was not Abraham or Jacob or Moses. I shall be asked why I was not Uzziah. Michel Foucault, it's very posh, you know, to drop the name Michel Foucault into a lecture. He said he once went to a hospital for the mentally ill, and it was filled with people who either consider themselves to be Louis XVI, Louis XV, or Napoleon. People were rushing up to him and saying, basically, you know, he's mad, he thinks he's Napoleon, but I'm the only true Napoleon here. Now, I doubt most of you don't look as if you think that you're Louis XVI or even Marie Antoinette. I may be mistaken. But we are tempted to go for what you might call rivalrous identities. Competitive identities. I overheard a friend of mine saying about somebody else we both knew, when I was in Balliol, you know, he was the third most intelligent person. Or the richest, or the sexiest, or the holiest. These are all ways we choose identity from what's on offer, rather than becoming someone, the person that we are in the eyes of God. The hero of Iris Murdoch's novel, Nuns and Soldiers, said, our vices are generally dull. The ordinary rotten mud of human meanness and cowardice and cruelty and egoism. And even when they're extreme, they're all the same. Only in our virtues are we original. Vices are general, virtues are particular. I think you could turn upside down the opening words of Anna Karenina, which says, all happy families are happy in the same way. All unhappy families are happy in each in their own way. It's the other way around, actually, I think. Why do we take refuge in ready-made identities I think in the end it's because we don't believe, sometimes at the beginning, that we can be loved as we are, just as we are. A saint is somebody who takes that risk. Now, this invitation to be yourself, to become the person God's grace can make you to be, can sound like a recipe for mediocrity and complacency. You know, embrace the inner slob. But it's not, actually. It's a highly demanding task of evolving with God's grace. Now, the classic text for looking at what it means to be a friend of God, the classic text is the Transfiguration. Because there, Jesus takes his closest group, his most intimate friends, who are with him in all the most important moments of his life, right up to Gethsemane, who are struggling to understand what it means to be a disciple. And he takes and teaches them. That's just the St. Mark's version. What I want to do, you see, is what I want to home in onto is two little paradoxes, which I think are at least implicit in this text. And they're paradoxes about what it means to be a saint. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who was talking with Jesus. Now Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." And suddenly when they looked around, they saw no one, anyone, anymore, but only Jesus. Two paradoxes. First paradox about how you live in time. And a second paradox, which is about identity. He was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." I think we see here one aspect of what it means to be a friend of God, or a friend of Jesus. I do not call you servants, I call you friends. And that is that you delight to loiter in God's company, to taste the sweetness of being with the one who is your friend. In your presence there is fullness of joy, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. And I think in everybody who is trying to welcome that friendship, there will be brief moments of savouring, if you want, just the pleasure of being with God. They may be brief, and many of the holiest people feel exiled from that sometimes for years, something like Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who I knew. Many, many years of her life she was living in an arid wilderness where God seemed absent. But I would say that being open just to taste the goodness of the Lord, to want to spend, waste time with God. If you're somebody's friend, you want to waste time with them. I was at my Benedictine school. I'm afraid, rather a bad boy. I was one of those who used to smack behind the cricket pavilion. And I knew the way to the nearest pub, safe pub. And I have to confess that I was almost expelled from school for reading Lady Chatterley's Lover during benediction. I think my father rang the headmaster and saved me. But there was one moment I remember when I was alone in the Abbey Church, and for a brief moment, you could say, the veil lifted, and one had a sense of that joy in the Lord. Be still and know that I'm God. And it sort of lodged in my unconscious, I think, waiting for the moment when I would respond to the invitation. Jacques Kerouac said in a letter, I read, I might say, at 4:30 this afternoon, all of life is a foreign country. And are these moments when you glimpse, if you want, the end of the journey. C.S. Lewis said, the beauty rises up the desire for our own far-off country, the home that we've never lived in, but we're destined for. These are moments that you can't plan for, you can't demand them. They're pure grace and gift. And they may come rarely, but they are invitations. And in some ways, I think they even transcend some of the divisions between the faiths. If you read a Hasidic rabbi or a Sufi mystic, you can recognize in them that own experience of utter gratuity, of that unmerited grace which we live as being Christ's friendship. And sometimes, you know, for people at an early stage, it might not even be recognized as explicitly religious. It might be what Jacques Maritain called a natural mysticism, where you sense in some experience of beauty a summons. B. Griffiths, who became a Benedictine monk and lived in India, he said, I came to where, he was about 10 at the time, I came to where the sun was setting over the playing fields. A lark rose suddenly from the ground beside the tree where I was standing and poured out its song above my head and then sank, still singing, to rest. Everything then grew still as the sunset faded and the veil of dusk began to cover the earth. I remember now the feeling of awe which came over me. I felt inclined to kneel on the ground as though I had been standing in the presence of an angel. And I hardly dared to look on the face of the sky because it seemed as though it was but a veil for the face of God. When I spent a lot of my time travelling, over half the year, whenever I fly back to England, they always ask me, is London your final destination? And I can't always resist saying, I hope not. I hope not. I hope it's paradise. So that, I think, is the first thing I just want to suggest, is the invitation to loiter with the Lord. But there's Peter happily sort of basking around in the glory. And he hears a voice which says, this is my son, listen to him. And this voice, of course, summons him to come down the mountain and to make the journey to Jerusalem, where Christ must suffer and die. 2 points, one very brief. That in the end we have to come down from the mountain and just get on with the rather boring business of stopping being mean. Meister Eckhart, who was a 14th century Dominican, in his talks of instruction for Dominican novices, and they were surely very attracted to ecstatic experiences, said even if someone were in rapture like St. Paul and knew a sick person needed some soup, it is far better that you left the rapture of love and would serve the needy person in greater need. See, becoming holy sounds rather ethereal, doesn't it? Complex spiritual exercises, maybe a bit of levitation if you're lucky. But actually, saints know it's the boring business of just stopping cruelty to other people, escaping from that bubble of egoism. But I think, and this was where I read your, reread Rob's email, perhaps you might find it a bit more provocative. I think actually also Jesus is inviting the disciples to undertake what you might call the great adventure of Christianity, which is to walk with Jesus to death and resurrection. That's a love that's going to make you, undo you, and raise you up. The early patristic scholars used to say, God became human so that we could become divine. For the first 1,500 years of Christianity, absolutely fundamental to the faith of most Christians, East and West, was the belief that you were called to be transformed and to share the very life of God. And that was the reason which people threw away, if you want, in many ways, ordinary lives with a wonderful sort of craziness, like St. Francis, you know, casting off his rich clothes and becoming God's truth. And Charles Taylor, in an extraordinary book, which I know Rob has read, but and I hope all of you will read at some stage, The Secular Age, Charles Taylor argues that really in the 16th century, much of Christianity began to lose that sense of the radical adventure of what they called divinization, utter transformation. And he says, heaven became just an eternal extension of domestic bliss. Ordinary human happiness was enough. The plus was that there was a profound sense, which you already see in Luther, of holiness could be granted through an ordinary human life with marriage and sex and making money and career. I think the negative, according to Charles Taylor, and I'm not a historian, is that Christianity lost some of its folly, its craziness, so that somebody like St. Francis ceased to be comprehensible. Charles Taylor wrote, if God's purpose for us is simply that we flourish by the judicious use of industry and instrumental reason, then what possible use could we have for a St. Francis, who in a great elan of love calls on his followers to dedicate themselves to a life of poverty? At best, this must lower GNP by withdrawing these mendicants from the workforce, but worse, it can lower the morale of the productive. Better to accept the limitations of our nature as self-loving creatures and make the best of it. So you see, Charles Taylor plots how 16th, 17th century in much of Christianity, heaven becomes rather like an eternal celestial version of Brighton, with the angels to do the domestic chores. I came across a journalist the other day who took down a death notice, and he transcribed a requiescat, as in R.I.P., as requires a cat. Understandable need, I suppose, but not quite the summons to heroic adventure. C.S. Lewis, his grandpa, described heaven as eternal conversations on theology with St. Paul, two clerical gentlemen in their club. I suspect that the young will only really be excited by Christianity if they are touched by this sense of a dramatic adventure that will turn you upside down, unmake you, remake you, so that you share God's own life. people aren't going to be satisfied with a nice bit of gentle spirituality with some Myers-Briggs, you know. We owe the young the very best. Which reminds me, irrelevantly, of one of our brethren in the New York province who had a bit of a problem with drink. And he went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, "Well, Father, you know, the very best thing you could do would be to give up drink altogether." And he replied, "Doctor, I am not worthy of the very best." What's the second best? Have any of you seen that extraordinary film of Gods and Men? And if you haven't, leave immediately and go and see it. It's a profoundly moving film about a community of Cistercian monks, just eight of them, up in the Atlas Mountains, Algeria, who find themselves caught up in the rise of Islamicist terrorism. And they have to, it's true, it's all taken from the diaries and the letters of the monks. And they have to decide whether to stay or whether to go. One of the youngest monks, Christoph, he says, "But I didn't join the order to get murdered." And the prior said, "You've given away your life already." Walking the walk. What time? How are we doing for time?
8:05.
Sorry?
8:05.
More time if you want.
Yeah. I'll bring this to a fairly rapid end. I'll look very briefly at another paradox, which is, do we know who we are? And Peter did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." See, these disciples are Jesus' intimate friends, his companions. And when he reveals that he must go to Jerusalem and he must die, they cannot accept it. And Peter began to rebuke him. For a new translation by a friend of mine, Nick King from Campion, Peter scolded him. See, Peter is like a parent or a teacher. He successfully managed to confess that Jesus is the Messiah. And he knows what Messiahs do. And one of the things they don't do is go and get crucified. So he knows who Jesus is better than Jesus does. But when they see Jesus in glory, they are terrified. And that's not because he's more powerful than they thought. It's because they realize that they never knew who he was. That he is the friend of Elijah and Moses. And he is the son of the voice, which says, "This is my son, listen to him." They tried to possess Jesus. They tried to own him. They tried to keep him in their categories. They wished to define him. But on the mountain, his reveal is not belonging to them. And they don't know who he is. And that means that if you get caught up in him, then you don't know who you are either. St. Paul says, "It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." Or Colossians, "Set your mind on things that are above, not the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ." Our lives are hidden with Christ. So we cannot know who we are. One of my brethren joined in a bishop the same day as me, Simon Tugwell, wrote, "The essential source of my identity is God. Within my own interiority in myself is God's interiority in me. God is the heart of our heart. But that means that there is a mystery at the source of ourselves. But we are indeed truly the source of our lives, then we cannot expect to grasp, to fathom that source. In the language of St. Thomas Aquinas, we can't apprehend the essence of our souls." So, you know, you're drawing near the end, because we get back to identity.
Our society is obsessed with identity, with branding ourselves, with staking a claim to projecting an image. But I think to be caught up in the life of Christ, to be befriended by Christ, is to know that you don't know who you are, because you are in him. When Dietrich Bonhoeffer was in prison, he was tormented by this question, who am I? And the gap between what other people thought of him and what he knew of himself. And finally he was liberated. He said, who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. But whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. People get us wrong. If you get involved publicly as one of the friends of Jesus, then you will be misunderstood. And the temptation is to be very angry when you're misrepresented. But if we know that our lives are hidden in Christ and we don't know who we are, we shouldn't be very surprised if other people don't know who we are either. Rowan Williams assures us that I need assurance on this point. He said, to see, to feel the cross as a light load is the impossible possibility of faith. Letting our best loved pictures of ourselves and our achievements die. Trying to live without the protection we're used to. It'll feel like hell most of the time. But the real hell is never to be able to rest from the labours of self-defence. It's a great liberation not actually particularly to care about what people think about you, or even what you think about yourself. If you think that you're the new St. Thomas Aquinas, as I'm sure many Dominicans do, then of course, you know, writing the great book, receiving the recognition, being free to study, become essential to your identity. And if you're denied them, then you are denied. Whereas if you happily don't know who you are, because your life is hidden in Christ, then maybe you teach it, maybe it goes well, maybe it doesn't, then you do something else. And what you are to be will be revealed in due time. It liberates you from rivalry. Because there's nobody else in the world who wants to be Timothy Radcliffe. That's the one side. And then suddenly they looked around and they saw no one there anymore, but only Jesus. Finally, Jesus is given back to them. He's restored. Moses and Elijah have gone. And he is again the one they know as their friend. And I think there is a tension in our journey to holiness that we both have to accept ourselves as we are, but also not know fully who we are. Because if a saint is somebody becoming the person who God created them to be, then nobody else is really like anyone else. We're each unique. A saint is somebody whose particularity slowly emerges into visibility. These ready-made identities, you know, as good or bad, or stud, aggressor, rich person, winner, joker, whatever, you can leave them behind. Often, you know, certainly in my beloved Catholic Church, when we celebrate the saints of the feasts, which we do a lot, they have sort of standard hymns, you know. You know that all apostles are going to be wonderful and all martyrs are brave and all virgins are pure, you know. Whereas in fact, each is the distinctive process of a face emerging. I mean, we all have many faces. I'm not quite the same person with my families, with my friends, or with my brethren. I'm not quite the same person giving a lecture, sitting in a pub, sorry to put a Catholic. I'm not quite the same person, you know, after with a beggar as with a benefactor. I hope I'm not two-faced. But I think one's face emerges, it's like a picture coming into focus as you live your life and feel God's healing grace. So, often they say that it's only when you die and you relax and you no longer, the face relaxes and then the hidden goodness and beauty of a person emerges into the light. So often our faces are buried, you know, by the struggle to put on a brave face, to hide fear and uncertainty, and to save those we love from suffering. There's a Nigerian proverb: if your face is swollen from the severe beatings of life, smile and pretend that you're a fat man. And I think that the face that a saint acquires also looks at you and me with penetration and sees us as we are. They don't look at us to condemn us. They look at us as the friends we could become. That's much more frightening. Graham Greene describes going to visit Padre Pio, who was a Capuchin friar who died in 1968. Very famous holy man. And afterwards, Graham Greene was there with his mistress. And afterwards, he got a message from Padre Pio saying, "Oh, come along and say hello." But he didn't go. He was too afraid that he would be seen as he was, not as a sinner, but he would be seen as somebody who's potentially a saint. That's a frightening invitation. I was invited to see him that night in the monastery, but I made excuses not to go, as neither of us wanted our lives changed. So that's the tension, the paradox that I leave with you. We don't know who we are because our lives are hidden in Christ, and yet we must accept ourselves as we are. And I think that just as in theology you know you have what's called the via negativa, where you draw closer to God, not by knowing who God is, because you can't know who God is. Thomas Aquinas, who I'm sure you all devout can study, Aquinas said we are joined to God in this life as to the unknown. We draw close by shedding wrong, false images of God, having them stripped away. And perhaps it's the same with ourselves. We have a sort of via negativa. Who we are is infinitely richer than we can know. But we can go through the stripping of false images of ourselves as we draw nearer to God. And it's high time I stopped. Hubert Humphrey, when he was Vice President of the United States, was very proud of his oratory. And his wife once said to him, "Hubert, you may believe your words are eternal, but it doesn't mean to say that you have to go on and on."
Thank you very much, Father Radcliffe. Now we open the floor for questions.
Don't forget, no question is a silly question, only the answers.
Okay, I think it's kind of customary that the moderator asks the first question. So my question is, I guess you said no questions are silly. But my question, when you spoke there, it just kind of spoke to me in my current position as a graduate student who's about to graduate and who's going to look for a job and trying to figure out in terms of, you know, the way jobs define us. And I mean, when you ask, you can ask people, you know, what does your father do or who is your father? And we can answer the question a lot in terms of sorry, you can't ask someone who is your father and can answer in terms of what your father does. I was just wondering if you can just say anything in relation to that, in relation to students seeking their identity in their jobs, you know, after they finish.
I think it's an incredibly difficult moment, actually, for anybody seeking a job. I heard of a son of a friend of mine today, a very bright young guy, got a first, and he's actually getting a job as buying manager for Morrison's supermarket, which is far away from his original dreams. I think that one of the distinctions, which I would have talked about if I'd been able to talk for a couple of hours and you were very blessed, is Eric Fromm makes an interesting distinction between what you have and what you and who you are, having and being. And very often, I think in our society, we define ourselves by what we have. It could be possessions, it could be a job, it could be a reputation, it could be, you know, your iPhone and so on, looking guilty. but in the end, we're not defined by what we have, and we're defined by who we are. And I think it's a moment where, if you could, the combination of the consumerism of our society, which so much of which is about what you can have. We have to be able to be liberated from that, I think. It's interesting, there was a sense, even when I was a child, that some jobs were vocations. So teaching or being a nurse or a doctor, or these were vocations, which is why we didn't have to pay them very much. As we've switched our society, as it's become more consumerist, actually that whole notion of vocation has also been weakened. Whereas a series of consumer choices, Nicholas Boyle from Cambridge wrote a beautiful article about the loss of the idea of vocation. You know, one week the choice you're making is what car you're going to get, or will it be a loft extension, or and so we have to be. I think it would be very important for me. Sorry, I'm rambling on. I'll stop in a moment. That's giving them time to think of questions. It would be great to recover the sense that every human life is a vocation. To be alive is a vocation. It's to be called into being. And that the job that you have, for better for worse, if you can get one, you have to see how it actually enters into that long-term shaping of your life, which is a response to the one who calls you to himself. And it may or may not. I mean, you could end up by being an academic or a politician in a way that very explicitly brings to light the vocation that you are. Say, but you might end up by having a life that's very simple, but that also may have its rival in that the shape of your life as you journey to God. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. I was just
It's a question of how we might promote this sense of the great adventure, how the churches can do this, particularly in this moment for the young. I think that what we have to do is to touch
their own sense of adventure. Most people have it. Whether it's, I don't know, the Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter. I'm not actually, I have to say, an uncle of Daniel Radcliffe, although this is sometimes reported in the press. I went to the book signing, you know, in Paris, and I couldn't understand why there were about 500 people with copies of my book. And as they went by, I heard one of them say, "Ah, c'est l'oncle de Harry Potter." I didn't say anything until I'd sold all the books, of course. But I think you can. I think basically the biggest virtue we need at this moment is courage. And to believe that young people can do something extraordinary. And I think in our culture is so founded on health and safety, that it systematically discourages us from taking risk. So I think it's very important that the churches actually encourage people to take risks and to do slightly mad things. And that we let young people know that they could too. When I talk with the young, and I've got to go and give a talk next Saturday to 300 or 400 young people from Northampton Diocese, I would want to evoke some of the extraordinary things that people have done. I had to write a preface this morning for a book about a French Dominican who called Jean-Joseph Lataste, who in 1835 founded a new congregation of sisters who had been prisoners and prostitutes. Now this, in the 1830s in France or anywhere in Europe, the idea that people who'd been sent to prison mainly for theft or infanticide or prostitution, that they could become sisters was incredible. He was 32 when he founded it. We normally think, you know, you've got to wait till you're about my age for you to do anything solid, you know. And so I think actually confidence in the young, which means the freedom to make lots of mistakes. You mentioned the church, and the churches. Often people talk about the institutional church, you know, the institution. I think any healthy society, including the churches, has multiple institutions, and which give authority and voice to different people. So in my own, you know, people imagine always you've got Pope and bishops and priests and things, but you also have religious orders and universities and fraternities and lay movements and multiple institutions. And I think we need institutional creativity at this moment. Because faced with the rather monolithic form, as certainly seen in the press, of some of our churches, the temptation is to retreat into solitary individualism. Because I think what we need to do is a lot more institutional creativity.
What you're just saying about individualism, you said that modern society is obsessed with identity, but it's also obsessed about identity as individuals, and maybe there's a paradox in that we find our identity through other people rather than through thinking about, you know, who we are ourselves, and that just as our identity is hidden in Christ, it's actually that's quite a hard concept to deal with sometimes.
Sure.
And I don't know how I'd necessarily go about finding that out, but finding your identity in other people might be a slightly, I don't know, maybe that's more accessible.
Absolutely. And I think that actually when people do have strong identification with communities, whether it's your family or your college or your tribe or your clan, paradoxically, this makes very strong individuals. I've spent a lot of my time in Africa. Rwanda, Burundi, Nigeria, and so on. And you would imagine as an outsider, but the image, therefore, of strong clan or tribal identity would make people individually weak, but it's actually quite the opposite. It's quite the opposite. And what you find often, I find, coming back to the West, having spent 9, 10 years on the road, is that often actually what our individualism does, if it makes us frightened to be committed and loyal to the people that we're bound up with, actually we become very timid and afraid and dare risk things.
You talked about finding those places in which we find joy, in which we delight in God. I wonder whether you could tell us, and I think that, I mean, they vary kind of from person to person and they develop throughout our own lives. And I wonder whether you could tell us a bit about the important moments in your life where you've experienced that and how that's shaped your conception of who you are.
I mentioned an early one when I was at school. A sort of moment of silence and joy. That sort of lay in the background, as it were. When I left school, I had what was going to be a gap year. For the first time, I made lots of friends with people who weren't Christian. And they began to say to me, "But what you believe is a load of rubbish. It isn't true. True." And I was really tormented. Is it true? I mean, I came from a very Catholic background and very religious background. Not pious, thanks be to God, but deeply religious, if you know what I mean. And I'd never been confronted with this question of truth. And it really got to me. And then there was a second moment, I'd say, which was important. I remembered that there was an order which had the motto truth. But I couldn't remember which it was. So I telephoned around and said, "It's the Dominican." Very fast, very fast. So I then wanted to join the order. I went to see the provincial. And all he wanted to talk about was football. He thought a sort of 19-year-old would be really interested in football. I was no interest in football at all. And I got a bit irritated. Then I was invited to go and stay in the novitiate in the west of England. And I went, you won't believe this, but I was a smart young man in those days. I went down in my city suit and tie and everything, and my umbrella and briefcase. And I was met by these two slightly shady looking characters on the platform wearing old duffel coats. And they whipped me off to the pub, being good Catholics. What I discovered was a freedom of speech. You could say anything. You had freedom to say whatever came to your to mind. And this enormous liberty. And I think when I joined the order, that was the great excitement. Was the liberty of word, the liberty of mind. And that doctrine doesn't take away your liberty of mind. It opens it up. It's the great prejudice of our society, is to think that doctrine's constraining. Actually, it's liberating. Then I got ordained. That's another story. By many ways, I resisted ordination because I always had a deep distrust of anything like clericalism. But anyway, I got ordained, and then there was a long, rather barren period where I didn't, you know, I believed in God. I never doubted God's existence, but God seemed remote, and suddenly food and sex and all sorts of other things seemed a great deal more interesting. It wasn't a dark night of the soul. I call it more a grey evening. That makes any sense. I just knew I had to hang in. And then it was in the Garden of Gethsemane, outside Jerusalem, that somehow the awareness of God came back, and the joy of that. It wasn't that I said, "Gosh, there's somebody around here," you know. It was more like reconnecting with the one who's at the core of our being all the time. I always love St. Augustine saying, he said, God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. And so often I think the rediscovery of the presence of God, it's not going out there, it's going deeper into yourself, but that raw point where you're loved into existence at every moment. So Catherine of Siena, 14th century Dominican, she said, go into the cell of self-knowledge. Now that sounds rather introverted, but what she meant was go to that point of yourself where you're a we, because actually we're a we before we're an I, ontologically. We're a we because God is loving us into existence. If you go deep enough, somehow you're touched by that point of your being as a gift. I had lots of other points, but I can see what time is creeping on. So we probably stop there. Those would be various names.
Any other questions? Comments?
Perhaps if I could just say that when we talk about saints, and they're important in my tradition, it might look as if we need saints because God is remote. And that's why I particularly wanted to bring in that quotation from Augustine. That's not true, you see. God is closer to us than any saint could be. God is closer to us than any friend could be. As Augustine said, God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. So when we have a sense of the sense, it's not because God is remote, it's the very opposite. That there are signs, if you want, precisely of God's intimacy. If that makes any sense. I can see puzzle looks.
Well, if no one else... Oh, Joseph.
So, I think the first paradox you raised about this gratuitous use of time, I find that fascinating, I can relate to that. But there's this sense of tension between I and we and, you know, institutional church. So, how can a community gratuitously spend its time for God in that sense? Because we're all busy people, I mean, you can...
Yeah.
I just shut myself in my room, that's fine, but something like, you know, a mass or corporate worship. So.
For us, in my tradition, you're expected to have at least half an hour of just solitary silence in the presence of God every day. I know if I don't do it first thing, it's not done at all. But what is thoroughly encouraging is if you come down and you find that there are other brethren there, fairly early, just being there, and you're there together. Just being. Not thinking anything in particular. Just being empty. I mean, I always talked about emptiness, but I already had too much to say. I think that in the whole tradition there's a lot to be said about self-emptying. That there is, the heart Pascal, I think he said, is that there is a God-shaped void in every human being. And the temptation is to fill it with activity or alcohol or food or whatever. It's to fill the hole. I think a lot of that silent prayer is about together, ideally. Many traditions, you always have that time together to live with the emptiness that only God can fill. That he is the only one that can ultimately fill that void. And a lot of the discipline, I think, of spirituality is that is learning not to fill it. Busyness is the greatest temptation. To be with it, and if you are with the silence and the emptiness, then one day, maybe when you're least expecting it, it will be filled, and that's when the joy comes.
Okay, I think we'll close. Speaking
about the paradox of sanity, one of the biggest paradoxes to me seems to be that a lot of people expect to find joy and happiness, and a lot of saints have actually found suffering and pain, and sometimes a nasty death, and starting with the apostles and all the way to the present times. Can you speak about that?
Sure, I think it's a very important point. I think that there really is only joy if you also learn to be capable of sorrow. Because what it says in the Bible is that I will take out of you a heart of stone and I will give you a heart of flesh. And I think that what we hope for is that we will be given hearts of flesh. And if you are a heart of flesh, then you will be both vastly joyful, but also you will be sensitive to the pain of the world more acutely than us hard-hearted people are. And that's why I think all the greatest saints are both capable of vast joy, but deep sorrow. St. Dominic, they said he laughed in the day with his brothers, and he wept at night with God. And I think that you need both of them. Or St. Francis of Assisi, you know, he was the poverello, a man of immense joy, spontaneity, but he was also the man of the stigmata, so identifying with Christ and with Christ's pain. So I think they go together. And if you had somebody that was just suffered and was gloomy and glum, I would say something was lacking there. You have to have both. Have you ever come across Charles de Foucault? He went into the desert in Algeria. There were so many people who've gone there out into the desert, and he founded an order out there to reach out to Islam. And one day he came back to Paris, and he met a nephew of his, who's a very rich young man. And the nephew said, "I thought my life was joyful until I met my uncle." And then he said, "I had a first glimpse of what real joy might be." And when I used to travel around the order, that's one of the things you looked out for. Are the brethren joyful? And they're usually joyful if they are vulnerable to the suffering of the world. If you try and hedge yourself around and protect yourself from the world's suffering, you're always fearful of what you're going to lose. And so you will have a dull heart and a dull mind. So I think that there is a sorrow which is not at all incompatible with joy.
All right, I think we'll really end it there. So, just before you leave, we have a money box where we take donations. Right, it's not mandatory, but if you have extra change, then we won't send it.
Nobody's looking.
Right, thanks. Just remember, no GCU next week, Monday, but Tim Keller will be in town, so bring in non-Christian friends as well. I'll see you there.